Hello, do I have any issues with you? Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddham dhammam sangham namassami. So today it's Wampura, it's half moon day. We have our usual peace vigil, as Ajahn Sumedho used to call them, to kind of inspire the community rather than to think of it as trudging through the mind full of kilesas and miseries and sloth and torpor and all these mental states that arise as the night goes on. Peace vigil, that's kind of more uplifting somehow to the heart, to imagine that we can give something to the world rather than just endure misery. And today it's been a very beautiful day, very beautiful, very kind of mellow, beautiful weather. The breeze, a little kind of gentle wind, sometimes not so gentle, but I caught my mind doing the chanting tonight, and I was looking through the window and I thought the least thing in harmony with the surrounding is my mind right now. I was kind of chanting this beautiful kind of Pali chant, and I just noticed, I was looking at the grass kind of moving through the with the wind and this beautiful gentle grass just outside there. It's dry and it's just mellow. And I caught myself kind of, I suddenly saw the sort of background voices of my mind. You know, you should be chanting a little bit more heart and you should have a bit more energy and there should be a bit more, oh dear, you've missed that word. So, oh well, you got a bit more love into it. And it was like just a kind of a whisper in the background, and as I watched these the grass kind of moving in the wind, I suddenly remember the word that Ajahn Amaro was mentioned yesterday as we were doing he was doing the reading of the book that him and Ajahn Pasanu are working on. The word tamata came up, and sort of which means just in accord with Dhamma, and he was explaining how the teacher who's used this word mostly was this Ajahn Buddhadasa, this famous meditation master in Thailand, playing on the ending of this word being ta, means in Thai language means the eye, so the eye of Dhamma, or seen through the eye of Dhamma. And this word came up when I was observing this delightful little scene outside, of things just being as they are. There's just the wind is blowing, the grass is kind of bending over, and it's been spring has come, and the night summer is getting yellow, and there was my mind kind of, instead of chanting and enjoying the chant, it's kind of, oh, we should be doing this way, we should be doing that way. It's like going to the grass and saying, you should be bending that way, and the wind should be blowing this way, and summer should come after spring, and you know, and you shouldn't have the season in good order in the way they are arranged. You should have them differently. So that was kind of brought back. Suddenly my mind relaxed totally, just observing those grass kind of floating in the wind. And it kind of brought to mind how many times do we do this to ourselves, just through the practice, with this wonderful practice that the Buddha's kind of handed down to us. And how many times do we brutalize ourselves trying to be a good practitioner instead of actually looking at the mind as it is? I don't think the Buddha ever wanted us to kind of make ourselves, make the mind a certain way. He wanted us to be just, to observe the mind as just nature, Dhamma. So he didn't ask, it wasn't a teaching that was inviting us to force and push things in a certain way or to deliberately make the mind, make the mind a certain way, but just to observe, just whatever arises, whatever passes away, whatever comes, whatever goes. How difficult it is to be at that fine point where the mind is actually seen for what it is, just like grass blowing in the wind, just like the wind itself, just like the mind as it is, just it's in its naturalness, in a relaxed, open way. Sometimes when I watch the group of people here just meditating, you can see, including myself, I'm sure I just look just the same as anyone here, this kind of frown look, kind of deeply concentrating on something, which very intense face. And it makes me wonder what we do with ourselves, because this is a natural, this is a very kind of a natural way of the mind that is driven by willfulness to become all tangled up with this desire to become the practitioner, the Buddhist, the meditator. And none of us are spared from that. It's just part of the journey, really. It's like anything new that we learn. At first we are very clumsy and awkward. Imagine, remember the time when you had a little tricycle when you were a child, and even three wheels, you had a hard time just to get on that bicycle, on that tricycle. It was hard. Imagine, remember the time when you had to start swimming, when somebody threw you in the water, and how difficult it was to imagine you could survive. I've seen myself, I studied dance, and I remember my first steps as a dancer and people around me, how clumsy we looked, trying to do things rather than just doing it. So at first, a lot of the practice is trying. We try very hard to meditate. We try very hard to concentrate. We try very hard to get rid of the hindrances, really, which means most of the mind, which is pretty hard going on us, isn't it? When we start the practice, you can see most of the what fill the mind is what we call the five hindrances. This kind of love and hate, restlessness and worry, anxiety, dullness, lost torpor, wanting to not be anything, and then doubt. Just the ongoing question in mind, wondering what to do next, whether we're doing the right way, whether we're not, whether we should be going this way or that way, whether what happened yesterday was a good meditation or not, whether what's happened tonight, was it, did I do it right or not, and so on. So there is a very strong tendency, especially at the beginning of practice, to want to become something that we are at the moment we think we are not. Like, you may think you have a lot of problem with sloth and torpor, so you want to become somebody who hasn't got that, who doesn't have to face sleepiness. And strangely enough, that very wanting not to face sleepiness seem to fuel the very cause that creates sleepiness. It's a strange law, really, that not wanting something seem to fuel the very thing you don't want, very causes, the very things that causes, for example, sloth and torpor. I still kind of sometimes baffled by this, how this happened so regularly, not wanting something create the very thing you don't want. You know, you don't want sexual desires. That very thing, just obsess the mind, was a lot of sexual desires. You don't want to experience the sexual energy in the body. That very fear of experiencing that creates fantasy and fear. Fear of having to experience those fantasy, sexual fantasy. And one of the quickest ways to avoid sexual fantasy is sleep. So, you know, you could say it's a bargain in a way. Many in Thailand, I remember, some of the monks used to sleep a lot. You know, you could see at Wat Phananachab during the all-night sitting, everybody is kind of nodding off and right, left and center in all directions. And of course my righteous mind used to think, well, what are those monks doing, you know? In a way, I talked to one of the senior monks about this, you know, and it was really kind of compassionate response. He said, well, you know, those young monks, there's a lot of, you know, sexual energy sometimes is so strong, you know, they just dump it down and fall asleep. Which was, you know, not something I would have thought of. It's obviously somebody experienced who knew. And so in the monastic life where most of the doorway to sensual experiences are shut down, then I don't know how many people could understand that, what it is to be in that form when all the doorway or the gates to desires, to the fulfillment of sensual desires are actually shut. Now, you could say, well, this is, what a terrible thing to do. This is really inhuman. To want to shut down all this, all the pleasures, all the gateway to the sensual pleasures. But you have to remember that one doesn't become a monk or a nun unless you find some kind of pleasure. I don't think none of us are creatures of pain. None of us are here to experience more pain. We are here to, because we know somehow that there's something pleasurable about renouncing sense desires. I don't think one can be fooled by that. There's something pleasurable in giving up those sensory experiences. And perhaps maybe that's, you know, one doesn't look at this in that way at first. You know, there's a kind of a driving force behind our intention to become a samana, to become a monk or a nun. And that intention is not very clear. You know, we know somehow that it's better than where we came from, but we don't even know where it's taking us. We don't even know where we're going. So the mind is, you know, the mind that is used to knowing, you know, to programming itself into actually doing something, going somewhere, becoming somebody. The mind that is used to that kind of programming, when you come to the monastic life, it's really, you know, it's an enormous challenge to just not being following that program. I was talking with my sister on the phone recently, and she said to me, you know, she's on the spiritual path herself, and in a quite disciplined way, but she's also working full time and so on. And there was always this sense that, you know, wondering whether she can understand the life I'm leading, you know, because her life is filled up with activity in a way. It's going somewhere, doing something, even though her intention is not to do that, but the whole program is still in action. And then she said to me, you know, sometimes I imagine you going to your kuti and just spending hours just doing nothing. And she says, I don't know if I could do that. I would not know what to do. And I said, well, welcome to the monastic life. A great part of this life is just seeing the mind kind of in a sort of baffled state saying, what do I do next kind of thing. Of course you have the whole training, you know, sort of, I'm supposed to be meditating and I'm supposed to be sitting. I'm supposed to be concentrating. I'm supposed to let go of the hindrances, I'm supposed to develop the mind, I'm supposed to arouse effort and energy in myself, I'm supposed to sleep only a few hours. I think we all know that. I think most of us here are intelligent enough to have memorized what we're supposed to be doing. It's another story when you sit in your kuti. Somehow, all the wisdom of those that one is supposed to be doing, somehow it goes out of the window. It's quite a hard work to actually bring the mind back into focus and say, now what do I do next, kind of thing. Then you look around your kutis and look at the wall, and it's in tremendous sense of aloneness and comes up, sort of sense of being really alone and completely, especially at the beginning of the training, that aloneness is very powerful. You don't have a good friend you can call and say, shall we have a cup of tea and have a drink together? Let's go to the pub and have a little good time and a little chat and catch up with this. There we are, faced with ourselves, with just the mind as it is, and the mind is going, wow, I don't want to be here. Oh, wow, how can I do something? How can I become something? How can I, can I eat something? Is there anything I can eat? Is there anything I can drink, Is there anything I can get hold of, Get my hand on to something. And there we are, for hours on end sometimes, just facing the tiger, Not only we have the monkey's mind, but we're also this raging tiger in there, And so not many people, there's not much of an understanding of what the stillness, of this life is actually activating. It's not activating the still person, I can assure you. It's activating that roaring tiger there. They're just kind of lying dormant for a while, Sometimes it's dormant and it looks kind of nice. It's like a pet, Sometimes it has a kind of pet feeling. It's kind of sweet, it's telling, oh, you're doing fine now, If you meditate a little bit more, you'll be all right. Our meditation really went well today. It's really nice. I was really kind of calm and quiet, concentrated. And it doesn't mind being kind of cuddled and kind of caressed and tapped, And everything seems to be going fine. The knees are not aching today and the back is kind of, upright, and the breathing is going fine, and the thoughts are pleasant. It's a nice day, and you can think of all sorts of good memories come together. Following the pleasant feelings, some pleasant memories come along, and remember the good old days at Chitters or in England or here or in your childhood, perhaps childhood memories of the good time when it was summer and things were lovely and pleasant and comfortable. And you feel, my meditation is really doing very well now today. I really had a good day of meditation. This is the beginning of the fooling, being fooled. This is a voice that starts saying, see, let's just pat you a little bit more, You're not hungry, you don't have any great desire for anything, you haven't had a quarrel for some time with somebody, nobody has stepped on your feet, your toes for a while, you haven't had anybody kind of arguing with you or kind of telling you how stupid you are or implying it. And it feels very pleasant. And you think, I think I like to ordain now. I like to ordain. I think I'm made for this life. I think I ordain as a bhikkhu finally. This is a nice day today. Or if you're a bhikkhu, you say, well, I ordain for life. I have no doubt now. And then something happens. Like one of those beautiful days followed by a rainy day, and where everything looks grumpy and kind of grey and damp, and and everything is wet, soaked. And then the mind gets, oh dear, that beautiful mind state that I was holding for about 5-6 hours yesterday, that's just gone. Why is it? I used to have this at Chittas in the early years when I used to go to the forest. I used to get away. That was a vipava tanha. I used to kind of push me out to the forest. I don't want to see anybody. I don't want to have anything to do with anybody. I just want to be alone. And I just want to be alone forever. You just go to the forest for a few hours. And you think you're really being a good practitioner following the Dhamma. But really, it's good we don't know our intention a lot of the time. All these subconscious motives, you know, that kind of drives you into practicing. So that used to drive me into practicing for about several hours in the forest on my own. Nothing else will do it. It was just pure pure hatred of the community, pure aversion to everything that was happening in the community. That used to drive me into meditating for a few hours alone in the forest. And then of course you thought, the forest was calm and quiet and it was a beautiful day and you kind of come to a point of stillness and balance and felt really good about yourself. Started loving everybody in the community, spreading metta. The mind was broad, open, and happy. And then, lo and behold, whenever I would come back to the community, the first person I would meet on my path would be the one that I used to find most irritating in the community. And within a split second, all my metta would completely disappear. My mind will be thrown into deep angst. And suddenly realizing that what I had imagined to be at least semi-permanent, maybe not permanent because I knew a bit more than that, semi-permanent, something kind of had some solidity to it, or just would disappear just in the snap of a finger, would just go. And we can spend a number of years just kind of going from one to the other, you know. So at some point you feel maybe that, you know, hatred will drive you into meditating. And feeling a good meditator will drive you into a sheer greed, you know. Like you may think, oh well, you know, I've been really doing quite well. My practice is going fine, I think, you know. I haven't been angry with anybody for a few days. I haven't been too impatient either. I felt quite good about myself. I've been, you know, generally fairly equanimous. You know, and the next thing you know is that you are your hand in a bar of chocolate and you're holding that bar and your mind, the thought that most kind of forefront of your mind is nobody's going to get that bar of chocolate, I'm just going to eat it all. You know. And you say, well, how did that happen? I thought I was thinking about fasting yesterday. What a strange thing. Why suddenly I'm holding this bar of chocolate and the most intense thought in the mind is nobody's going to have it but me. Yeah. And we can do that with other things, you know. It's like you can do this with your girlfriend or your boyfriend, you know. It's like when you start liking them, so nobody's going to have her or him but me. And if somebody's it can be anything, your dog, your girlfriend, your boyfriend, your partner, your house, your favorite CD, your favorite musical instrument or your favorite piece of music, you know, no one's going to sing that except me. I'm going to be the best. So this is the mind, isn't it? You come across teachings that almost look like Buddhism, but not quite. I was talking to, that person remained nameless since I'm being taped. Some teachings that talk about beingness and silence and being one with things. You know. And those teachings feel so good that your mind is really in a state of turmoil. And you're full of confusion and doubts and worry. And you hold a book that tells you, just be. Just be. That feels... Yeah, can I be? you know, why do I have to investigate all these mental states all the time? They drive me mad. Can I just be? You know? So the Buddhist teaching is a kind of, requires, I think, something other than just being. Eventually, I think that leads us to this being, but the process, you know, is much more energetic at some point than just being. It's energetic because it requires an absolute wakefulness, not a kind of trance, not a belief into a mental state that's going to sort you out forever, that being. But there's kind of absolute wakefulness right there into that which is and that which isn't, you know, the being and non-being, you know. It's totally uncomfortable. It's totally, you know, challenging the status quo of our belief system constantly. It doesn't give you much of a leeway into, you know, when it comes to just sitting here and believing that this moment is real, that mental state is real, that emotions is real, that's really what I'm going to be forever. Now I feel wise. Let's be this forever. Have you ever come across that mental state that just believes truly that you could be wise for the rest of your life now, that you have had this great insight into the nature of anger or the nature of greed or the nature of sexuality or the nature of jealousy or envy? I will never have this again, you know. So it is a challenge to our belief system, you know. Because most of our, most of the system, you could say, is built up on certain thought patterns. And there are primary thought patterns, you could say, like the hindrances, like love and hate, you know, wanting to love, wanting to be loved, wanting to love others, wanting, you know, and then the shadow of this, hate, which are primary patterns. You can see that almost in the mind. It's kind of being activated constantly. You know, you love the idea of sitting and then you sit for 5 minutes and you start hating it because your knees ache, you know. You love the food that's being offered. Maybe it's nice and just a thing you like, but somebody is just taking more and then you end up with a small portion about the thing you like. And even the thing you like, when you get everything as much as you want, your greed is saying, no, I want more than that. So it spoils the fun in a way, because there might not be more. You know. Or you like somebody up to a certain point, and the pattern is at some point they do something that they just kind of blow your mind, and you think, oh my God, how can that person that really liked and loved and was infatuated with suddenly pick her nose or his nose, or start doing things, silly things, or said something that really irritating. And how disappointing that is for the mind, isn't it? Suddenly, when you see somebody that you really like doing stupid things, what you consider stupid. Yeah. So this kind of love-hate, primary movement of the mind, you know, the deluded mind. You know, it's present all the time in the mind. It's present all the time. It's creating itself. It creates constantly, recreates itself. I remember having an insight once how the mind, you know, what is this mind? I mean, what is it? What is it, that thing that suddenly make you, you know, maybe sit still for a while and then create, you have a pain in the knee, and suddenly it conjures up all sorts of things. You know, I'm going to go out. No, I think I need to go to the loo. I think, and I don't think meditation is for me. You know, I think I need to do something else. You know, and 5 minutes earlier, you were fine. You were actually peaceful and still and quiet. And suddenly, there it is. It hasn't come from nowhere, anywhere you can pinpoint. It's like the wind, isn't it? You don't know where it's coming from, except that you know its direction because it's blowing on objects. You know, it's hitting like a tree. Things that move, and you know the direction they move, you know, oh, the wind is coming from the north, the wind is coming from the south, from the west, from the east, northeast, northwest, and so on. Yeah. And you say, well, you know, what happens? I was feeling peaceful, and suddenly I'm angry. And so, I remember realizing how the mind has a way of, if there is no mindfulness, it keeps recreating these primary patterns by themselves. Without mindfulness, that all it knows. It's interesting that those five hindrances, it's there in the mind all the time. Until you get free from them, you know, until you start liberating the mind from their, you know, from their influences. If you observe them, like let's say restlessness and restlessness, you know, when you're young, for example, you know, when one is young, you could say most of the energy is very restless. When you get middle-aged, it's a little bit less restless because there's less energy. But for young people, for people who ordained young, when I was young, once upon a time, when I was a young nun, you know, I had enough energy to walk full of rage for about 3 miles non-stop. A rage, it was a kind of restlessness that came just from being irritated about something, and it turned into maybe not rage, maybe just that kind of restlessness. I still remember Ajahn Amaro once walking on Pindapat, you know, he was alone walking on Pindapat on the road at Chittas. I don't know what happened to me, but I find myself striding off, you know, walking at about probably at least 10 miles an hour and seeing him in the distance and say, oh my God, I have to slow down, you know, I couldn't stand it because you couldn't walk in front of monks in those days. You have to walk behind them and you could, overtaking them was just not bad, good manners. And I remember seeing him in the distance and walking really slowly, and I felt totally kind of challenged. I thought, no, I can't stand that. I'm not going to stop. And I didn't stop, in fact. And I was marching. I had a pair of boots, I remember. It was kind of cold, and I just marched, and I walked past him and pretended I hadn't seen him at all. I just marched on, and just there was a kind of object on my right, and I walked completely undaunted for about 4 miles and came back to the kitchen at Chittas, where I just left in the morning. Something had happened, I don't know what it was, but without that kind of restlessness energy, you would never be able to do that, you know. If you were more calm and kind of placid type, you'll just be kind of, you know, gently working out your rage somewhere in the corner of the field that chitters somewhere, you know, quietly sitting, maybe looking at the sky. But that kind of restlessness and energy can make you walk up and down the mountain 20 times a day without being tired. You know, it can make you. But ask a young person to sit down quietly for an hour, two or three. You know, that's another thing. And sloth and torpor just kind of fall onto us immediately. It's really interesting how that happens, you know, from restlessness and worry to sloth. It's a pattern of the mind, you know. One creates the other. It's like people who have a very activated mind. I notice in our community, people who think a lot, great planners, they just think a lot. They just know how to do things. They plan very, very well. As soon as they end up on their cushion, they just kind of fall asleep. It's very interesting. That mental activity, as soon as it's being made aware of, and when the awareness is not strong enough yet to actually keep the mind awake, when there's just that suddenly that stopping, the mind is not going anywhere, it doesn't have to think about anything. you know, and it just falls asleep. The message says, oh, well, nothing to think about, sleep. So, you know, it's interesting that those hindrances seem, I mean, that even the concept hindrance seem, has a kind of negative connotation. It's a hindrance. And the Buddha says, I mean, has amazing images to describe what those hindrances are, you know, like, you know, far, you know, a turbulent water, you know, a water that is full of weeds and slimes, you know, it has, you know, all the images that the Buddha uses to describe what those hindrances are pretty, you know, graphic and not particularly nice, quite negative. I mean, it's not pleasant images. Describing how it's like being lost, you know, lost, like having a debt, you know, being attacked and so on. But the hindrances themselves, you know, I find it's, you know, very important to realize that those hindrances are actually quite good friends. They're not bad. They are the very thing that wake us up, interestingly enough. It's only my greed that has woke me up to the fact that I realized that I wasn't interested to follow it. You know, it's only the pain of my greed that gave me an inkling to the way out of. Not that I'm not greedy anymore. don't imagine that at all. But it's just by being fully awake to this pattern of greed that I suddenly, the insight came, yes, greed is painful. You know. But to see the pain of greed, you must not run away from it anymore. You must not try to be somebody who is not greedy. Because that's another trick of the mind. Trying to become somebody who is not greedy. This happened after retreat. I remember when you have been, let's say, deprived of sensory activity for a while, when the mind quiets down, when the heart is fairly calm, you haven't had any verbal interaction with people, there's a certain degree of contentment in oneself. You find the greed kind of seems is dormant. We think, oh, I don't have any greed now. It's just nicely dormant, kind of coiled on itself like little snakes, you know, and it's kind of quietly sleepy. And you think, oh, I remember thinking, I don't think I'll be so greedy anymore. I think I'll be able to handle the food, and I won't have to suffer. I mean, the greed wasn't a problem; it's the suffering really that bothered me. You know, greed. Oh well, never mind being greedy. But I did not want to suffer. You see how mindfulness, the meditation, can take you to that point where, the Buddhist teaching can be can trick you into being enlightened almost. You know, it doesn't say you should not, you know, watch greed. It says watch suffering of greed. Because greed itself comes and goes. It's not a big deal really. You know, anger comes and goes. Sloth and torpor comes and goes. But what we often miss is the suffering. And that very suffering is what wakes us up. So most of the time we are caught into that kind of dilemma. I've got to become somebody who is not greedy, so we miss the lesson of greed, or you just kind of forget all about being not greedy or greedy, and you just indulge, you know. And then you miss the suffering of greed. So you can see when the Buddha talks about dukkha, it doesn't mean suffering in the sense that, you know, you have a wound somewhere and you it hurts, and, you know, or you have an indigestion, or you have a pain of, you know, maybe a mental pain or something. He's talking about reality. So dukkha is another word for reality. that edge there, which says, look, when you look at reality of greed, it's painful. When you look at the reality of anger, it's painful. When you look at the reality of sloth and torpor, it's painful. And what a mature step it is, isn't it, to actually come to that point where you can observe something which is painful and not follow it. Observe something which is inherently, you know, unsatisfactory and not follow it. This is much more mature than just sitting quietly and leaving everything dormant, pretending to be. And sometimes it has a beautiful quality. I mean, I'm not saying that this is wrong, you know, because sometimes that direction of being and being present and still can bring, allow the wisdom in one's heart and the compassion in one's heart to arise. You know, so don't get me wrong in that, you know, not criticizing the, you know, the a teaching that leads to a state of being. But the Buddhist teaching is pointing to something which is other than that. It's telling you what, at the moment, where you are at, the reality of your mind. It's showing you the truth. It's not fooling you into pretending to be something other than you are. And it's a mature teaching because it requires the ability to love, in a way, the truth, you know, to love the truth, to love, even to love the thing you dislike, like thing like a hindrance. Hindrance is horribly painful. Having to endure, you know, the sensory, the desire for sensory satisfaction, it's really painful. I mean, every day you see this in the line of food, you know. Your mind is saying, oh, I like that, I want it now, as much as I can. You know, for me, it's, well, maybe I shouldn't say it because people are going to start bringing them to the community. No, I won't tell you what it is. But there are certain things, there's a certain food that blow, you know, like even if I'm on a fast or I've given up on this, on that, my mind says, I want it. I'm going to have it. After 23 years, I mean, you would think that one is a bit better, you know, one should have improved on one's responses. Well, I have improved on the responses in the sense that I don't feel like I have to have it, you know. But it's like, you know, I'm going to have it. And so having just to look at this and say, right, this is fine. My raging tiger is wanting the whole dish. It doesn't want to leave anything for anybody else. That's fine. So having to look at the tiger that is completely selfish, completely blind, totally kind of one-pointed on that piece of this or that, whatever it is. And just to know that, you know, only through maybe sometimes few years of just watching this again and again and again, do you get at some point the mind start not grasping anymore. It has a space to be. There you are, see? But you don't want just to be sitting on the pile of hindrances that are just completely suppressed, do you? Trying to become the meditator that you think you should be, you know? We're not trying to be that. The practice takes you to that space where you're actually completely awake at that, as T.S. Eliot says so beautifully, you know, to be at that intersection of time and timelessness, timelessness being, and time, the activity that comes from thought, which is creates time, you know, to be at the intersection of that mind that keeps creating the time reality and that timelessness, to be at the intersection of time and timelessness, is an activity of the saint, being a holy person. And it says, not an activity either, but something taken and given in a lifetime in a lifetime, death, in love, surrender, and self-sacrifice. You know. It's a beautiful...
Love, other, selflessness, and self-surrender.
Self-surrender, yeah. And self-sacrifice, no?
Ardor. Love, ardor, selflessness, and
ardor? No. It's not in there. Sorry. I will remember it. It's not a word I like. Ardor. Maybe I'll check. But anyway, it expressed beautifully, in a way, the, you know, what this life is about. You know, this kind of self-surrender. You know, that self-surrender. That just that ability just to not mind being the way we are. You know, we don't think of self-surrender in that way, do we? Surrendering just to the way it is. It doesn't mean following. It doesn't mean, I'm going to be greedy. It doesn't mean I'm going to be angry. It's just allowing the mind to be just as it is and surrendering. Okay, letting go. At that moment, just let go of what is here, now. Rather than doing like I was doing in the chanting. Well, I've got to push this out. I've got to push my greed. I've got to focus on really doing the right thing. I've got to become something that is not greedy. I've got to, you know, not become angry. I've got to stop fighting. I've got to da 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 da. And instead, just to be there and say, okay, I'm angry right now. Okay. What does it feel like? Okay. You know. Now, ideally, quote unquote, we should be able to do that, shouldn't we? The teaching says you can let it go, you know. But most of the time, there's much more of a construct around what we experience. So we experience something, and then somehow, this is the way the ego's responses, it builds on things. It starts creating others, you know, something other than what he is. You noticed? Karmic formations. The beginning of the Paticca-samuppada. His translation is so to the point. Avidya complicates everything. That's a wisdom translation. You won't find it in many places. But that's translation from wisdom direct. Avidya, which is really what you say it's a self. That's the reality created through self. Through the grasping of self, through the identification with what we call self, me. You know, avijja padjaya sankhara. Avijja complicates everything. It complicates, it builds, it creates more than is. You know. And it's an ongoing realization of that. You know. Like doing the all-night sitting. Those all-night sitting, how much one creates. I mean, how many years did I spend thinking my all-night sitting was only midnight chocolates and cheese? We didn't have cheese in the early days. But, I mean, that could have been really devastating for somebody who like inspired thoughts and inspired feelings. And you find yourself thinking all-night sitting. Ajahn Sumedho will go on about peace vigil and giving, and your mind will just think midnight chocolate, cheese, stop, meditating. Isn't it funny? So that's where the practice is taking you, to see what the mind is truly up to, you know. Because then I find that even though it can take a long time to come to that realization that the mind is not really what we are. The mind is not something we can control very much. We can control up to a certain point. We can guide it, we can train it, we can, you know, we can give some direction to the way, to the mind itself. We can train our thoughts, we can train our feelings in certain ways. That's what the practice is about. Developing metta, developing skillful states of mind, developing a right speech, developing right action, and so on. This is a way of guiding the energy in the right direction. But most of the time, we have those two sides. You know, the one that is the part of the mind that is quite interested in being a good person, you know, a good meditator, a good monk, a good nun. And then the other side of it, that just couldn't care less. You know, in good moments you want to be a good nun, you know, but at other moments, you know, I've seen the mind really up to the most incredible mental states, you know, that is as far away as being a good nun as, you know, the moon and the next galaxy. You know, how do you accommodate this in a mind that is intent on liberation, on developing the good, you know? And interestingly enough, you don't see the two extremes in a normal everyday life. You know, you see the two extremes when the mind is challenged. It's very interesting how the mind is totally, if the mind is challenged when you give up something that it's accustomed to, that it's used to, you know. Or you're put into a situation which is not, habitual. Or you go into a group of people that maybe you find threatening or you're not used to. Whatever is inhabitual is not, you know, it's not a familiar, let's say, will be an unfamiliar situation, an unfamiliar group of people, an unfamiliar whatever, you know, feelings will bring a challenge to the mind, will suddenly get the monster out of the cupboard, as I call it, you know. So you can see that why the Buddha was pointing to a life that is moving away from that sense of just comfort. You know, because comfort, in a way, tend to make the raging tiger sleepy. You know, it just sleeps there nicely. It's kind of dormant. It's nice. It's kind of pleasant. You know, it's like a pet. You know, many people have nowadays little baby tiger pet or little lion maybe, but mostly I think it's tigers, you know. So you can feed them, as long as you feed them a lot, they won't kind of bite your arm, you know, but you just keep giving them lots of meat. But the moment you don't give any meat, well, you rather not have that little tiger as a pet, you know, because it might start kind of wrecking the house. Which is a bit what the mind is like. As long as you kind of give it all the food it needs, it's just kind of nice and dormant, it's on the carpet there, snoring away, and it looks at you with tender looking eyes, and it has a kind of little smile, even you can even detect a little smile on its face, you know, even though it might just be about, you know, it could easily bite you if it didn't have all the food it needs. So as long as you keep getting the steak out of the fridge, you know, give it to it, it will be all right. It won't bother you. And so monastic life is really, it's analogous to not feeding the tiger. It's like suddenly you start not giving it the piece of steak it's used to. You don't give the amount of milk it's used to drink. And not only that, but, you know, you stop taking that little tiger out for a little walk and run. There you are, tied on your cushion, you know. And so it starts kind of going, oh, I don't like that, you know. So there's two responses to that, you know. You can just kind of sleep, find other ways of going to sleep. And ascetic practices do that. Many people who do ascetic practices tend to sleep a lot, you know, not necessarily, lying down, but their mind tend to kind of shut down quite a bit, I noticed. You know? That's one response, and that's quite a natural, I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. It's not a judgment on sleeping, but it's just the tendency of the mind to respond to deprivation is to dumb down just fall asleep. And then the other way, you know, is to, you know, trying to become a better tiger. We want to improve on the performance, you know. And that can work for a while. You know, we turn the tiger into a human being that is really in control and in charge. You know. So the human being becomes a monk and nun. So now we are a monk or a nun, or so the tiger has become a monk, or the tiger has become a nun, and that, you know, and then we get a training. You know, and we might forget we even have a tiger. Actually, the practice itself can make the mind, has a potential to make the mind very dull if we just follow it as a kind of a technique or as a discipline, you know, in, as an end in itself, you know. And so the training and the teaching itself, one has to be very careful how one picks it up, because it can have, you know, the dulling effect of a discipline, the discipline of the, which is dead in itself, doesn't have any life. A discipline has no life in itself. It dulls the mind, in fact. If there is no awareness, if there is no awareness of what the discipline does to the mind, of how the mind lives through that discipline, how it is responding to the discipline, how it is reacting to it, how it hates it and loves it and whatever, find equanimous about it, whatever responses it has. So it's really a fine art to pick up a discipline, to pick up a training, to pick up a convention, and not turn it into another dull, another dull mode of thinking, mode of being, mode of relating to the world. You know, it's a very fine line, and it's not that easy to see what one is doing, you know, because at first, for a few years, one has to be a bit in the dark. We don't know. We don't quite know where we're going, you know. We just at the period we're trying this, and that doesn't work. We're trying that works better, and then suddenly the mind just collapses and doesn't want to try anything. Just kind of tired, had enough, you know. So it's a time when one has to be very, very patient with the mind, very, very patient, because one doesn't want to make it different than it is, but you want also to see when it becomes, you know, when the mind start being fooled by its own delusion, you want to see when it becomes deluded. Because a delusion is a great source of pain, it's a cause for a lot of suffering in our life. So you want to see when it's doing this, but you don't want to reprogram it into having to be something, you know, to be something even good at the limit. But for a while, we will program ourselves. For a while, we will. That's how it feels, to counteract unskillful habit. Just developing, for example, something like metta for a while, you can do practice of metta. That's like a reprogramming yourself in a certain way. But you have to know yourself. It's only a reprogramming. It's not liberation. It's not an end in itself. It's just a way of helping the mind to naturally go into the right direction, the direction which is a non-suffering, the road to non-suffering. Most of our habits are following the road of suffering. And to redirect that, it takes training. This is why we are monastics. This is why you are here training. We're here interested in this teaching, because it's helping you to guide the mind into the realm of non-suffering. But even that is not an end in itself. Even that is not an end in itself. You know? Because it's only another, you know, recreating a skillful conditioning. But then, if you cling to this, then you'll be very frightened when the shadow of that skillful conditioning turns up again. Oh my God, here I am, angry, irritated. I hate him, I hate her. Oh, I've been practicing metta all these weeks, all these months, you know. And here I am, hating my cats for meowing too much. Meow, meowing, meow. Making too much noise. Yeah. Oh, Janama, you didn't give me the clock, did you? I've got to start thinking. How long have I been talking? What? Okay. I'll leave you shortly. But I just want to say one more little thing. We were just on a Jinjamyan retreat recently. He's a very well-known meditation master, and some of us were attending his 7 wonderful days with him. And just to show you how the mind is, you know, I had one mantra during this retreat, and after the retreat, it was so clear, you know, this mantra was lovely. It was like inclining to Nibbana, you know, like inclining to Nibbana. I've heard my teacher say that many times, but it kind of became more real, you know, it was inclining to Nibbana. It means Nibbana was not a threat anymore. Nibbana can be very threatening for our ego, you know. Can't stand it. So it was just it was like an insight into the fact that inclining to Nibbana, inclining to ending, letting things go, you know, and just resting in a piece of, just piece of being, really. Not through forcing it, but just naturally, that just letting things go and just being there with things as they are. It was just that sense of something totally safe and totally empowering, you know. The sense of emptiness can be very frightening and disempowering for our sense of self. But that feeling suddenly empowered by the fact that by this letting things die, letting things go, and feeling the mind actually strengthen and more wider and more open, more just the mind is enhanced by this quality of not recreating anything, just allowing things to go and resting in that place. It was so just to get a sense how the mind is so much more full, so fuller than that, fuller than what we fear, what we are normally when we try to sort out things, you know, trying to think them out and trying to kind of get our mind all, agitated, trying to solve our problems through thinking, trying to, think our way through. And suddenly, for me, it's like a real blessing. It's like almost like a sense of grace. It doesn't last that long, you know, but that sense of grace of feeling suddenly when things end, when you see things coming and rising and passing away, you know. And it's just so natural, just like the grass blowing in the wind, you know, just the mind, the wind arise and blow things away and that pass away. And another thing is blown and passes away again and again like that. Just a sense of naturalness and the flow of Dhamma, the flow of just the flow of the mind as it is. It's something so relaxing and so it's just something so so true, so real, you know. And you sense this when the sense of self is not so clinging and grasping. As soon as it gets hot, the sense of self goes, "Oh, you don't this and all that." You know? Even somebody today, I noticed just how it ruined my peace of mind for a little while. You know, I remember noticed. You know, I was talking with somebody, and you know, and he, that person made a gesture, this kind of thumb up, and. And I felt, obviously this person is judging. I have got the thumb down. It's like, oh, I'm a thumb down. He said, thumb up for this person, I must be a thumb down then. And it was this feeling, all my Nibbana, sort of, you know, all my inclination to go to Nibbana just kind of already gone. But I picked it up, I saw it, and I say, And the mind was trying to sort it out. You know, yes, but that person is really kind, da 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 da, and I shouldn't be like this, and yes, but you know, you remember you had this insight, you shouldn't be. And suddenly I just stop and say, and it was going on, and then just allowing, just trusting that, just letting things end in the silence of the mind was a way out, you know. And you know, I've seen this pattern for 20 years. It's not that it's new to me, but it's just one forgets, you know. One actually not, maybe one doesn't, for me it's a sense of blessing. It's like suddenly some, you see very clearly without any doubt, and then it goes again, you know, the one you try to justify it and try to complicate things, and then suddenly you see it, you just rest in that arising, and then it passes away, and something new says, yes, that's the way, that's the way, that's the only way to go, don't complicate things, that's the only way, just, and things will get sorted out just like that. God, but that really caused something, that quite a confidence in not being a self anymore, you know, and not having to sustain and support that sense of self to relate to the world. And it's very I find it's a sense, what humility is about to me is that complete trust in letting things go and not having to recreate oneself in the face of others or in our relationship to others or to the world around us, you know. But it is not easy, you know. And 99% of the time we are dealing with a mind that's kind of saying, well, you shouldn't have done this, and you shouldn't have done that, and you know, you should be better, and you should have sauce and torpor, and you should be sleeping, you know, you care less, and you know. So I think this is why the Buddha talks about patience in terms of the highest, you know, austerities, because this is really what all there is left, is that having to be extremely patient, endlessly patient, without any boundaries, you know, kind of limitless, eternal patience, to allow things just to go, then, you know, and they're not perfect, just to allow them to end. And feel strengthened by that, feel empowered and filled with the strength of our mind rather than deprived, which is often a sign, the ego creates a sign of deprivation whenever we let go of things. You know, even in the early years I remember just not having everything that was on the table, just food-wise. I remember hearing this voice, seeing a piece of pizza on the table, and hearing that little voice in my mind saying, oh, you've got to have it, you will never have it again. You will never have it again. It's really interesting, that little voice. You must have it, you'll never have it again. And I used to struggle with that so much, you know, that I don't remember having this voice, you know, it's a bother. And then it went, and eventually it went. But it was so powerful, it's like dying to the pizza, you know? Death, a real kind of grief, grief pattern. And that went on for many other things like that. And then finally it goes, you know, you don't have that. Yeah. But if you don't endure these little silly voices in the mind, you know, you won't free them in a way. You won't let them go, liberate them. So this is a night to see how much we can endure, I suppose. We're weak, we have our test of endurance and the patience. So even when I came here, I thought, oh my God, the Tabayagiri, I don't think I'll ever be able to do all night sitting every week. I mean, we used to do that in the early days, but now at Amaravati we do them every fortnight at least. And then, lo and behold, I managed to, you know, you think, oh, no, I can't do that. And I'm so grateful to be part of a community that helps me to take me beyond this fear, because it's just a fear, really. you know. And you might not see me tonight because I have to go to, I was going to say to Bangkok. I've got to go to San Francisco tomorrow and teach, so I'll be patient in a different way. Do we have a sitting until after 12 or 10 tomorrow? Or? Mm-hmm. As you know.